We are in the middle of the Yaakov, Yosef, and his brothers, the story arc that began in Parshas Vayeshev, or if you want to go back far enough, really Parshas Vayetze. We have this intertwined family dynamic that starts all the way there, and it goes pretty much till the end of Chumash Bereishis, till Parshas Vayechi. We have the final where the various protagonists in the story die at the beginning of Parshas Shmos. As we discussed, it actually continues millennia later. The Asar Haruge Malchus, there were still punishments being meted out. Rabbi Nabachya says that Yosef never actually forgave them. But I wanted to discuss tonight one thread that runs through the story, which could have discussed this back in Parshas Vayeshev, Parshas Vayigash, Parshas Miketz. But I want to discuss one specific point, which Chazal discusses and which actually has ramifications, halacha lemaisa, in the area of estate planning. And that is, there is a passage in the Talmud in Maseches Shabbos, number one here on the handouts. It says, Amar Rav bar Machasya, Amar Rav Chama bar Guri, Amar Rav, La'olam al yishana adam b'no ben abanim. A person should never make an invidious distinction. He should never single out in an invidious way one brother, one son, between among his other sons. Why not? Where do you see that? Common sense, I guess, but where do you see an example of this? Shebishvil mishkal shnei slam milas. For the, all on behalf of a paltry, two slam milas, the weight of two slam, of silk, of fine clothing. In other words, the ksonas pasim, the fancy coat, the fancy garment that Yaakov made Yosef, shenasen Yaakov li Yosef, Yosef mishar bana, because of this little thing, this little sign of recognition, all of Yaakov's estate, all his sheep, all his wealth, and this one particular mark of his affection he gave Yosef more than the other brothers, niskanu bo echav and niskagel adar v'yardo v'sein ul mitraim. Because of this, that triggered the jealousy of Yosef's brothers, that triggered the sale of Yosef. We discussed previously, the brothers may have felt they were justified based on various reasons, but at the end of the day, it was all rooted in this one invidious mark of distinction that Yaakov gave Yosef, that triggered the sale of Yosef, that triggered going down to Mitzrayim. Everything was rooted back in that story. Right, so, yes, as you're pointing out, for many of the major events in the biblical narrative, we often find three, four, five different causes. For example, why did Moshe go into Mitzrayim? Why did Moshe go down to, why didn't he make it to Eretz Yisrael? Because he said, because he didn't have faith in the Jews, because of the Meimariva, because of other reasons. We find similarly with Lot and Sodom. Why was Lot saved? In the merit of Avram, because of his Hachnasas Archim, because of, you know, so on and so forth, or one reason after another. So here also, yeah, we find for Yetzias Mitzrayim, we find lots of reasons. We find for the Korah Barzal, we find Yedo Ateda. We find Delaturia, because they were on a low Madrega. We find they worshipped Avodah Zarah. We find, you know, lots of different reasons in Midrashim. So yeah, that's true. And then this is a drasha, and it's hard to know how literally to take this as the only reason or the main reason, but it's at least a reason. It's an important idea that Chazal are telling us. It was because of the way that Yaakov played favorites among his sons that led to the exile in Egypt, and that is something that a person should never. Therefore, we see a person. That's something that a person should never do. Now, the irony is, the odd thing is, that this idea of favoritism is something that repeats itself throughout the story of Yosef and Yaakov and the brothers. So, for example, in Parshas Vayigash, coming week's parasha, so we say that it says that he gave after Yosef revealed himself to the brothers. So it says, the pasuk says, "L'kulam nasan le'ish chalifa smalos." He gave them all presents of suits of clothing. "Ulevinyamin nasan chamesh chalifas." To Binyamin he gave five changes of clothing. So the Gemara in Megillah here picks up on this and says, wait a second, I thought that was exactly what you're not supposed to do. Efshir davar shenitzar ba'osu tzadik, something that Yosef himself suffered mightily because of this. He ended up as a slave in Egypt because of this favoritism. You think he'd be sensitive to this? He kashel bo. And he brings that Gemara that it was because of this problem that Yosef ended up in Egypt. So how could he have made exactly the same mistake? So the Gemara says, Amar Rabban Yom Bar Yefes, remez ramez lo she'asud ben latzisim menu she'yatsim lufnei amelak b'chamisha levushim malchus. This wasn't just gross favoritism. This was a prophetic allusion. This was a symbolic statement that he would have a descendant, Mordechai, in the story of the Megillah, who would wear five royal garments, Tcheles, Vechor, and so on. There are five things mentioned in that pasuk. It doesn't really answer the question so well. You'd think it would still make them jealous. On a simple level, one would argue that there wasn't really an issue of jealousy here. First of all, because they would have recognized that those two were maternal brothers, and they weren't. They actually were. There were objective reasons why they were closer. Second, maybe an even bigger reason is that he actually was not involved in the sale of Yosef. It was only the brothers from the other wives of Yaakov who were involved in his sale. So surely they were in no position to object at this point. But nevertheless, it's noteworthy that the Gemara itself picks up on this point and feels it's a question and has to answer this idea that there was a prophetic allusion, and it wasn't just prophetic allusion to Mordechai at Tzaddik, and it wasn't just gross favoritism. We find in... In different contexts, yes and no. I mean, some of the laws, for example, of prohibited marital unions, there are certain distinctions between half-brothers through the father, half-brothers through the mother, full brothers, and most of the halachas are the same, but there are certain differences. Certain rules of the laws of inheritance, maybe we'll touch on later tonight, there are certain differences. So there are certain differences. That has more to do with the fact that the Torah sometimes recognizes patrilineal descent as being different from matrilineal descent, not necessarily because you're a closer brother or from two parents or one parent, but because for certain purposes the Torah gives special weight to either matrilineal or patrilineal descent. In terms of the level of brotherhood, do we find that a full brother is in any significant way more than a half brother? I'm not sure. But yeah, it's an interesting point. I'm not sure. Yeah, we'll touch on that a little bit later. Yeah, we'll be...
My point is, they're saying try not to differentiate between the children. Here, the Torah is actually saying differentiate.
Yeah, that's what we'll get to later tonight. The bulk of what I want to talk about tonight are some of how these halachas play out in the Torah's guidelines for Yerusha. But, yeah. In the Sefer Yifei Tohar, so he also addresses this question in the second half of the quote from the Yifei Tohar. He also addresses this question of why Yosef was playing favorites and giving Binyamin extra clothing. So he first suggests yet another approach. He says that it was hard for Binyamin to go. He was younger. He was his father's the apple of his eye. You see from the whole story that it was difficult for Binyamin to get away. So you see, it was difficult for Yaakov. I guess it was difficult for Binyamin too. Sometimes it's easier for a child to get away from a parent than it is for a parent to give up the child. But he seems to fail that Binyamin suffered from this. So maybe he had to give Binyamin extra. So he addressed this question. He points out also that that it's not so difficult to understand why he would have been given Binyamin extra. So he says that. And he discusses why the Gemara asks the question. He deals with why the Gemara is bothered by the question. But that's another reason, an obvious reason why, many reasons why Yosef could have done this without falling into the same trap that his father fell into years earlier. In the earlier section of the Yifei Tohar, he discusses yet another aspect of favoritism. This is going to be in Parshas Vayechi, when on Yaakov's deathbed, when he gives his parting instructions and his parting... Sorry? Right. So the Sikkelas Yadav, that he reversed his hands between Yosef's two sons. But even before that, even before the distinction between Ephraim and Manasseh, he says that he tells Yosef that he's going to give them Shechem Achad, that Yosef has. Anina Sati Lecha, Yaakov tells Yosef right before Revi in Parshas Vayechi, Anina Sati Lecha Shechem Achad Alachecha, I've given you an extra portion beyond your brothers, Hashalakachim Yad Hamari B'charbi V'kashti. I've given you Shechem Achad. There are different explanations for what Shechem means. Some Rashi brings, some say it means actually the city of Shechem, others say it means a portion, an extra portion, but in any event, he gave Yosef something extra that his brothers did not have. So here also the Yifei Tohar says again, what's Yaakov doing? The whole story started from Yaakov playing favorites among his brothers. So again, he asks this question that, how can he do this? How can he fall into the same trap? So he says that Yosef now was the king, so now people understood that he deserves to have more covered, and they wouldn't be jealous at this point. And I guess they'd be jealous he's the king in the first place, but that's also what led to the whole sale of Yosef. He goes on, he has a second explanation. He says, another explanation was he was asking a personal favor from Yosef. He was asking Yosef to get involved in his burial, which he calls it tircha, and also that, I guess, was politically sticky. He had to beg a favor from Paro. So he says Yosef deserved a little compensation for the special favor he was asking. He brings a third explanation that Yosef himself had behaved in such exemplary fashion toward them. They had behaved so badly to him, and he repaid them with tova tachas ra. He was so good to them, so he deserves a little recognition, a little acknowledgement of this. And also, he says he was given the bechara of a Reuven. Again, that kind of begs the question: why weren't they jealous he was given the bechara of a Reuven? But now that he was the bechar, he had kind of become the replacement bechar. So again, he deserved this kind of special treatment. And so these are various explanations that Achronim give for why Yaakov was able to play favorites with Yosef here before he died. Similarly, why Yosef played favorites to Binyamin, and so on. So again, we have all these different explanations. Some of them are easier to understand, some of them harder. But the basic point is that the Gemara tells us that we see from the original sin, so to speak, the original problem of Mechiras Yosef, who was rooted in playing favorites, and the Mefarshim have to struggle to explain all these other examples where Yaakov and Yosef continued to play favorites throughout the story.
The Gemara Megillah, they're asking a question on Yosef, why he gave Binyamin Hatzra, but the source text from Shabbos is really saying that a father shouldn't show favoritism to his children, not that brothers and sisters can't show favoritism to each other. I mean, and that's more biting, right, than the father should.
I hear that, yeah. I hear that. Binyamin suggesting another explanation for why Yosef could have done it. It hurts more from the father, who everyone feels they're counting on his support and his love, and to be spurned by a father is much more hurtful than to be spurned by a brother. Yep, I could hear that too. So basically, this halacha is brought by the poskim. This is a Gemara that appears in a somewhat agadic context. This is a halacha, though, that is brought, or halacha, or not clear whether it's a binding obligation or just a strong recommendation from Chazal. This is brought in the laws of inheritance, the laws of Yerusha, that it says a person should not distinguish between his children because it leads to jealousy. For example, in number 4, we have the Rambam's formulation, Tzivu Chachamim. This is always the topic people discuss when the Rambam uses language like Tzivu Chachamim. Well, the source, we know, the source of these passages in the Talmud, but the question is, when he says Tzivu, does that mean it's actually a binding halacha? Is it really an imperative? Is it simply a strong recommendation? It sounds like it's an actual commandment. Tzivu chachamim, shelo yishana adam ben abanim b'chayav. The Rambam uses the word b'chayav when he's alive. We'll discuss the significance of that shortly. Afilu b'davar muat, even a small amount, as the Gemara's language about Yosef is, that even a klei milas, even this relatively paltry little thing, this garment, even that triggered such a terrible spat between the brothers. In order that it shouldn't lead to competition and jealousy. If the Rambam himself tells you the source, refers back to the biblical passage, the brothers and Yosef, and the Rambam says, therefore, that you should not do this. Now the Rambam says, b'chayav. The Rambam goes out of his way to say you shouldn't do this when you're alive. Whenever you see something like this, we have to ask ourselves whether he means even b'chayav and certainly in your will, or he means dafka b'chayav and your will somehow it's different. We'll discuss that shortly, what the significance of B'chayev is. But we'll turn also to the Tur in number 5. The Tur, writing after the Rambam, he also brings this language down, but the Tur relates it to another halacha. There's another halacha, which I want to discuss today also. That is the halacha of Avurei Achsanta. As we'll see in the Talmudic passages soon, Chazal felt very strongly the Torah has a default order of Yerusha, just like the law has. If a person dies intestate, there are rules for which heirs get what the hierarchy is, who gets what. The law has rules, halacha has rules, lahavdil. And just like in the law and halacha, a person has the right, the ability to draw up a will. Now in halacha, there are all kinds of rules for how a will should be drawn up. We're not going to get into those details today. There are ways of drafting a proper halachic will, but just like in the law, you have to, if you're careful, you can draw up a will that'll take effect. In halacha, you can draw up a will that'll get around Yerusha of the Torah. They'll divide your assets in a different arrangement. However, halacha has something which is perhaps unique to halacha, unlike the law, which is even things which you do, which will be contractually and legally valid, halachically valid, you still may violate the Torah's preferences. The Torah doesn't want you to deviate in certain ways from the order of Yerusha. And if you do, you're sinning or you're acting in a way that the rabbis and that the Torah does not approve of. We'll discuss a little bit more of the details of what you can do, what you can't do soon. But the Torah links these two things together. He links the original thing we've been discussing, that Chazal didn't want you. Chazal said you shouldn't create invidious distinctions. And the second thing, that the you shouldn't deviate from the Torah's Yerusha, the Torah seems to combine the two. The Torah writes, Hanose nechasev l'acherim, if someone gives away his property to others, outsiders, v'iniach banim, he takes the inheritance away from his sons. Afal pi, as we discussed, masha asa asi, contractually it's valid. V'zacha makabel, the contract takes effect, it's binding, it's enforceable. Nevertheless, ein ruach hachamim noche menu. Ein ruach hachamim noche menu is the language of the Mishnah. It's a very difficult phrase to translate. Literally, it would be something like, the spirit of the sages does not approve of him. That's actually one translation. Others say he's not a person in who the spirit, a spirit of wisdom or a spirit of sagacity resides. Basically, it means it's something that we frown upon. One way or another, it's a phrase that appears in maybe a half dozen places in Shas. You can look in the entry in Encyclopedia Talmudis, where they have an entry for Ein Ruach Hachamim. You'll see all the different places it occurs and what the different suggestions, interpretations of various commentators are. One way or another, it is an expression of some level of disapproval. So the Torah says, Chazal, the Torah, do not approve of someone who is circumventing the Torah's order of inheritance. L'havra nach l'afilu m'ena yash nagin geshura. Then the Torah adds, Midas chasidus shlo yod v'layeh shumadim chashav etzavazu. Skip that line for the moment. You shouldn't even be a participant in such a procedure. The last line of the Torah, v'aseinu zal amru shlo yishana adam l'ben ben abanim afilu b'davar mu'ad shlo yavu l'idei kena. Very similar to the language of the Rambam. He then brings this other idea. A person shouldn't divide the Yerusha in ways that will cause jealousy among the heirs. Now, the Beis Yosef, the Bach, the early commentary.
So still talking about the will?
That's exactly the question. So if you look at paragraphs 8 and 6 and 7 here, that's what exercises the commentators. The Torah kind of segues very smoothly from discussions about the will to this other idea of not showing favoritism, which what we've seen until now, that means living people. The examples of Yaakov and Yosef and Binyamin, except that case of Shechem maybe, but all the other examples were people who were alive. And the Rambam, we pointed out, goes out of his way to say you shouldn't do it b'chayav. He's not discussing the will. The Torah starts talking about the will and then throws in this idea about not playing favorites, and that is what the Beis Yosef comments on. Beis Yosef says that the Torah juxtaposes these two halachas. Lomar, that even the first halacha about the wills is all, there's also an issue of kinna, of jealousy, of avoiding jealousy in the will itself. The Bach disagrees. The Bach makes the point you're making, and he says, no, not so. The Bach says, hasam b'chayav, when it comes to doing it when you're alive, that's the concern about jealousy. That's what the Gemara is worried about. That's what the Rambam was worried about, b'chayav. That's the concern. Avil, says the Bach, kodem misaso, you can do whatever you want. In somebody's will, on his deathbed, he has the right to do whatever he wants. He doesn't have to worry about jealousy anymore. And he brings a Gemara, which I have here in number 8. He brings a Gemara. The Gemara darshens a pasuk in Dvarim, in Kisetze, I think, that a person has the right to dispose of his property prior to his death as he sees fit, and there's no longer a concern about causing jealousy. Not immediately clear why that should be so. There's certainly plenty of jealousy that can arise in families based on will. It's probably a prime cause of jealousy. But nevertheless, I don't have all the sources in the handouts here, but this is something that the Achronim debated for a while afterwards, whether this concern of jealousy is, as the Rambam suggests, mechayim. It's something you have to worry about when the father's alive, or even, as the Torah of the Beis Yosef seems to say, even something that applies on a person's deathbed. For some reason, this halacha is not in Shulchan Aruch. The Rambam brings it, the Gemara brings it, the Torah brings it. It's not in Shulchan Aruch, so we can't really discuss how the Shulchan Aruch's formulation of it is. But the Beis Yosef seems to assume these halachas do apply on somebody's deathbed. And you know, I think we know that certainly the common sense and experience tells us that there is an enormous problem and potential for jealousy based on poorly designed wills. So. Yeah, certainly. I think, again, common sense and experience, at least equal, if not magnified, for how things are being. Father can't explain anymore. He's passing away, and that's machlokes achronim. That machlokes achronim. Whether this is a problem or not. Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely, again, yes, I meant to make that clear, that all these halachas we're discussing now and then tonight's discussion are all about l'chatchila, what you should be doing, what we approve of, what we don't approve of. none of this is going to affect the validity of the will. If structured properly, that's a whole separate discussion. How to structure a will so that it will be binding according to halacha, which again, there are ways to do it. It, you know, machlokes in about certain things, but there are ways to do it, no question. Everything we're discussing tonight has little or no effect on the binding nature of the will. It's just a question. If someone wants to do the right thing, if someone asks someone what to do, if someone wants to do the will of God, what he should or shouldn't do, but it will take effect regardless of what he does. Yes. Now, you can jump down to number 10 here, the Pesachei Choshen. Pesachei Choshen is a leading 20th century work in Choshen Mishpat, of Yeshaya Blau, or of Yaakov Blau in Yerushalayim, recently deceased. Pesachei Choshen is probably the single most important work on Choshen Mishpat in the 20th century. So he discusses the following question. He says, Yesh La'ayin, that if a person gives some heirs more than others, and it's a problem of kinnah. So he says, let's say a person wants to give, we know that the Torah says that in halacha, sons inherit, daughters, the benos tzalafcha, the daughters of tzalafcha, daughters inherit only if there are no sons. If there are both sons and daughters, sons inherit everything and daughters inherit nothing. Now, this is actually an area where halacha differs from secular law in two major ways. Obviously, one of them is that modern Western law does not distinguish between male and female heirs. Generally, some Islamic countries do, but modern Western countries do not. Also, another interesting point, I think, is that from what I understand of inheritance law, typically state by state, from what I understand of inheritance law, secular law often gives percentages. It'll say spouse gets this percentage, so children get that percentage. Halacha generally does not do that. Halacha has a rigid hierarchy. Generally, if any heirs exist in a given level of the hierarchy, they take everything, and heirs that are lower in the hierarchy get nothing. So anyone on the same level in the hierarchy has to split it equally. So if there are five sons, they split it in five ways. Five daughters, they split it five ways. But if there are sons and a father, for example, sons get everything, father gets nothing. If there's a father and an uncle, father gets everything, uncle gets nothing. Halacha, you never really divide an inheritance among heirs of different levels. But that's, you know, again, topic for a different discussion. But so Rav Blau wants to know in his Pesachei Choshen, he says, of course, so according to the Torah, the sons are going to inherit, daughters are not. And this is one of the most common reasons to write a will today, which is to give the daughters a share either equal to the sons or at least give them a substantial amount. This is an old tradition. This goes back to at least 500-600 years to the Ashkenazic Jews in pre-Shulchan Aruch times already, the late medieval period. It's actually an interesting historical question. This is one of those areas where halacha was kind of catching up to the history. We know from records, for the post-Kim record, there was an old tradition that parents would give, rich parents in particular, would give their daughters and son-in-laws a share of their estate. The post-Kim, beginning with the 15th and 16th century, then grappled to come up with halachic rationales for why that's okay, why that doesn't run afoul into these prohibitions against trying to circumvent the Torah's Yerusha. But we know they were doing it for at least 600 years or so. Actually, the way they used to do it was a little differently from the contemporary way. What we do in contemporary times is write a will. What they used to do was typically give the daughter and son-in-law a dowry settlement upon marriage. They would, even if it would either cash or if it wouldn't be cash, they would say that they would write some kind of contract telling the daughter and the new son-in-law that they will receive a share of the father-in-law's estate upon his passing. So we do it today as a general will. We dispose of all our property they gave in kind of individual dowry settlements. They would try to settle some of their estate upon the daughter and son-in-law, doing essentially the same thing that we would do in our will. Upon death, they make sure they got some of the estate. And the post can struggle with why that's justified, but it is justified. It's a venerable custom for many centuries. And that today is probably one of the most important reasons why somebody would be interested in writing a will in halacha. So Rav Blau wants to know. He says, if the daughters don't get anything, if somebody sticks to the Din Torah, they might be jealous of the sons. Certainly a girl today most likely would. She's grown up in Western culture. She expects to be treated equally to the sons. So she'll be very jealous of the sons, even though that's what the Torah said. So here we have a kind of curious thing. The Torah's raw halacha of giving sons and not daughters, on the one hand, we have a halachic value. You're supposed to preserve that as much as possible. On the other hand, we've seen today there's a question of jealousy, that you're supposed to avoid doing anything which will create jealousy. So in a modern situation, these two values are in conflict with each other. Give the daughters nothing, that creates jealousy. Give them something, you're circumventing what the Torah wants. So what should you do? So he says, and the same thing, the halacha is a bechor, an eldest child. in Torah law gets pishnayim, gets double what the other sons do. So for example, if there are three sons, the estate is divided into four portions, the Bechar gets two, the others get one each, so the Bechar has double what the other sons have. That also naturally makes the other sons, could make the other sons very jealous of the Bechar. So again, Reb Lau says he heard that somebody recommended that you give the other sons, you write a will to give the other sons equal, circumvent the Torah's rule of Bechar to avoid, to forestall jealousy among the children. So on the other hand, he says, the poskim usually seem to argue the other way, that the more conservative poskim seem to argue, the traditional view has been, you are supposed to preserve the Torah's inheritance law and not worried about Yerusha. So why not? So he says that, Reb Lau says, I don't know how satisfying this is, Reb Lau says, Tzarech lomar, kol she'enu mishana miseder Yerusha shekava Torah, as long as you're not departing from the rules the Torah itself sets down, which is boys get, girls don't get when there are boys, Bechar gets twice as much as everyone else, as long as you're sticking to what the Torah said, you don't have to worry about kinna, and you have to stick to what the Torah says. Again, the problem is there will be kinna. As a factual matter, this is nice in theory, but certainly, as a factual matter, there will be jealousy in many cases. Maybe if the people are not that Western, if they've grown up in Me'asharim, or if they're, you know, if the chinuch has been very good and they're deeply imbued with the values of the Torah, we can argue that in theory they shouldn't, but in the real world they will. And as I said before, Lamaisa, many rabbanim, many serious rabbanim will tell you that you should give the daughters something, and some say you should even give them equal to what the sons get, because again, the concern of kinna is an important concern, as we see from the parshas, as we see from these parshias, and Chazal themselves acknowledge kinna is important, and therefore that's a major reason for giving the daughters, in spite of the fact that the Torah generally doesn't want you to do that. Now, there is actually a dispute among the poskim about how much, even those who do advocate writing a will and giving the daughter something, there is actually a dispute about how much they should get. I mentioned earlier that the idea of writing a will and giving them something, or a dowry settlement, is an ancient one. It goes back to the late medieval period. The custom traditionally was not to give them as much as the sons. Again, just from the historical record, even, not even from the poskim, just what the poskim record of the actual prevailing custom, giving them half as much as the sons was common. The instrument was typically called a shtar chatzi zachar. Shtar chatzi zachar was, today we use it as a form of will. It's a kind of convoluted, you know, legal maneuver. I'm not going to get into how it works exactly, but for our purposes, it's the equivalent of a will. It's the means of awarding parts of the estate to someone, bequeathing parts of the estate to someone who wouldn't otherwise inherit it. And historically, the custom usually was that the daughters would not get as much as the sons. They would get only half as much. That's what we call it, chatzi zachar, half as much as the male children. Now, as I said, this is more a historical account than a halachic one. Most of the poskim do not get into the question of why only half. Those who raise the question, it's against Torah, the girl shouldn't get anything, even half is against what the Torah said. And mostly the justifications they give, the rationalizations they give, would serve equally well to giving the girls kulo zachar, the entire, as much as the son. So we don't know for any certainty why the custom was to only give them half, whether there were halachic reasons, whether it was simply because they themselves culturally didn't feel the girls needed as much as the sons, whatever, we don't know what the reasons were. And it's worth noting that one of the leading, perhaps the leading expert in Choshen Mishpat, living Choshen Mishpat expert today, Rav Zalman Nechemi Goldberg in Eretz Yisrael, has written in his published articles that there is no halakhic reason to distinguish between chatzi zachar and kulo zachar, that the arguments for that justify chatzi zachar would equally justify kulo zachar. He actually adduces one or two historical sources, not the majority, but one or two, a minority of cases where they did give the girls as much as the sons, and he rules that there is no problem at all with giving the girls as much as the boys. And again, if you ask contemporary rabbanim today, I think you will get different answers about what the recommended distribution is. Some of them say, no problem, you should do whatever you want, do whatever you need to avoid jealousy, give them equal shares. Other rabbanim will say, no, that you really should be paying more deference to the Yerusha of the Torah, and you should not be giving them as much as the sons. There is a related custom that even in those old Ashkenazic traditions that they would give the girl a share of the Yerusha, very often they would exclude certain asset classes. Some of them would exclude Sfarim, the Sifrei Kodesh. They would say the girl gets a percentage of everything except for the Sfarim, the library, which goes solely to the male heirs. Sometimes they would say real estate would be excluded. You know, today, real estate can be for a middle-class person a large minority or even a majority of his assets. Back then, it may or may not have been true. Very often, real estate was excluded. So again, why they did that isn't always clear. One suggestion was that, again, they wanted to preserve Yerusha the Torah with regard to at least some assets or some asset classes, and then divide the rest according to the will. But they wanted to preserve one portion of the assets, one tranche of the assets, so to speak, where the Torah's rules would prevail. Again, that's something we may or may not do today. Certainly, with regard to real estate, that would kind of throw the whole thing open if you excluded the house from the. So I don't think we do that today, but Sfarim maybe we do. There is actually another opinion. Some poskim say that the prohibitions against circumventing the Yerusha is some poskim, a very lenient view says that only applies if you totally circumvent the Yerusha. As long as you leave some assets which are going to be divided according to the rules of the Torah, that's okay. The question is, what is the necessary value of some? So here we have, again, within this opinion, we have a spectrum of sub-opinions. Some say anything, even a small amount of money, even a few dollars, it'll be enough if you set aside some assets and say these will be divided according to Torah law, everything else according to the will. Some say it should be a davar chashuv, a significant amount. Moshe Feinstein took this view. Some say it should be a percentage of the total estate, maybe 20%. Other opinions, but again, this is another major opinion of the poskim, that the prohibition against circumventing Yerusha is only if you do it entirely, you dispose of the entire estate differently from the rules of the Torah. But as long as you leave some, particularly some significant portion of the estate, to be divvied up according to the rules of the Torah, that is going to be okay, and the rest can be divided up according to the will. Now, one very interesting question, which I was thinking about again recently, in reaction to the news that Mark Zuckerberg, Jewish guy, even if his wife is not, recently announced that he is going to leave, I think, 99% of his shares in Facebook. He did this actually to commemorate the birth of his daughter, his first child, his Bechara, I guess. He wrote an open letter to her declaring that he is giving away 99% of his fortune, of his Facebook shares. I think we're totaling about $45 billion at their current capitalization, to Tzedaka, which will immediately vault him into, I think, the single greatest, the single greatest Baal Tzedaka in recorded history, ahead of Gates, I think, ahead of Buffett. So the question is that appropriate? Is it appropriate in one's will to give away some, all, most of one's assets to Tzedaka? This is actually something that, the Jewish people have always been generous, philanthropic. This is certainly something which is discussed heavily in the poskim going back centuries, really going back millennia to the time of the Talmud. Surprisingly, though, the halacha is very unsettled on this point. Many of these halachas about circumventing the rules of Yerusha are matters of great dispute, running down from the time of the Gemaras are somewhat unclear and contradictory, and they run down all the way down to contemporary poskim, or kind of have very different opinions on what's appropriate, what's not. As we mentioned earlier, some poskim say as long as you leave over some assets, it's fine. Some say, nope, still a problem. Some say that anything you do during your life, a living bequest is fine. Some say it's not fine. Wills are not fine. Living gifts are not fine. Many, many disputes. One of the groups of the disputes concerns charity. Is it appropriate to give much, most, all of a person's estate upon death, or even when he's alive, to charity? This goes back, again, to a Gemara. This is a Gemara in Ksuvah, so number 9, the second half, the last couple of lines. The Gemara brings a story about Mar Okva. He said, when he was on his deathbed, he said, bring me Chush Benoit to Tzedakah. Let me see my records of how much money I've given to Tzedakah. So it says, Ashrech Tavaksiv Bei Shiva Alfi Dinri Sianki. He saw that he had given 7,000 of a certain coin. Amar Zvadoi Kalili. I don't have enough provisions. I haven't socked enough away to get me through to the next world. Urcha Rechikta, I have a long way to go. So he went ahead and he gave away another, the Gersa we have is Kam Bizbizei Lepalge Mamoni. He gave away another half of his estate. There are other Gersos, apparently a third of his estate. He gave away a lot of money, it seems, as he was dying. The Mara asks, Hechi Avdi Hachi, how are you allowed to do that? We know the regular rule is, Meiser, a person should give at least Meiser. A person should give up to a chomesh, if he's generous, up to a fifth, but he shouldn't give more than 20%. I'm a famous admonition of Chazal, Hamavazvez, Al Yavazvez, Yoser Mechomesh. You really shouldn't give more than 20%. Mara says, yeah, here again we find the same distinction between while you're alive and when a person's leaving this world, Hanimila Mechayim, Shemayer min chasav. A person has to be prudent. A person shouldn't dispose of all of his fortune because he has to make sure he has enough to get through life. La'achar misa leslan ba. When a person's dying, all the caps are lifted and there's no such rule. Some say there's no rule at all. You can give away all your money. Some say a half, like the example of the Gemara, a third. It's not entirely clear whether we pass like this Gemara at all. Many Rishonim and Achronim do. Some perhaps don't. But this Gemara doesn't mention anything about the heirs. Doesn't mention anything about the concern of disinheriting the heirs. Instead, it mentions a whole different concern about not giving too much tzedakah, and it says that doesn't apply when you're dying. This Gemara completely doesn't get involved in the question of the Torah's concern that the heirs should come into their own inheritance. So the poskim struggle with reconciling this with the general concern of the other Gemaras that a person should not dispose of his inheritance, should not disinherit his heirs. There was actually a very sharp argument about this 20 years ago in pages of tradition between one writer, Arthur Silver, I think he's a lawyer. He wrote very, very strongly that people should not be making large charitable bequests on their deathbed. People shouldn't encourage them to do so. It's wrong. He tried to argue a lengthy article, a 15-page article. It's not the will of the Torah. The Torah's will is that a person's assets should pass to his heirs. People should not be giving money to tzedakah. They shouldn't be encouraged to do so. It's not the halacha. And he argued at length that this is the wrong thing to do. There was a very sharp response to his article by Rav Herschel Schechter. I think the Rav Schechter in question is the one from YU. There is another Rav Herschel Schechter who sometimes gets confused. The spelling indicates that it is Rav Herschel Schechter of YU, although the tone of the article is a little sharp for him. But he wrote back. I guess he was concerned that if anyone would listen to this article and take it too seriously, it would cause havoc for the charitable institutions that rely on charitable contributions, especially the generous ones that Jews are wont to give on in their wills. So he wrote back a slashing article that it's not the halacha, that Mr. Silver misinterpreted all the sources, that no, that the mainstream halacha is that a person can and should give money to tzedakah on his deathbed. He should be encouraged to do so. And Mr. Silver wrote back, and they had a very heated argument about whether this is right or not. We're not going to get into all the different sources, but in general, as I said, it is a somewhat ambiguous point. The Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch apparently don't bring this Gemara of Marukva. They don't bring this special dispensation. And there is a lot of debate about whether these strictures about preserving inheritance and not disinheriting your sons or your heirs in general is something that should override the mitzvah of tzedakah. There's an interesting tshuva in the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer, obviously this thing has come up before. You have to wonder why this wasn't settled about 3,000 years ago. Somehow it wasn't. The Chasam Sofer has a seminal tshuva where he discusses this question. He addresses the question front and center. Is it appropriate to make a large bequest to tzedakah? All your assets, most of your assets, and which will mean disinheriting your children, like... So again, my wife points out Mr. Zuckerberg is, his daughter is not going to starve. 1% of Zuckerberg's current shares in Facebook, she'll have a lot more money than we'll ever see in our lives, most of us. But that's obviously something. Giving your children enough to make their way through the world obviously is important. But still, she could be a very, very rich young lady, and she's not going to be if at least won't start out very, very rich if Mark follows through. Sorry? Yes, that's true. He could have other assets. I'm sure he does. But still, it's a lot of money. It's tens of billions of dollars he's taking away. So the question is that appropriate?
Might be for her own good.
Yeah, so that's a point that's been made, too, that it's coming into too much money and doesn't always result in the best character, spiritual development. You can make that argument, too. But the Chasam Sofer was discussing this question. The Chasam Sofer's case, the person did not have children. But there are other heirs. There were, after children, there are other heirs who stand to inherit. The question was, is it appropriate to disinherit them in favor of tzedakah, take away much or most of the money? He says yes. He makes a special argument for someone who's dying childless. He says the person has a special need for zchus and for kapara. But he seems to be suggesting that an ordinary person who has sons should not be doing this. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he's inclined to argue that even a person who has children, who Hashem has blessed with children, still has the right to make significant charitable bequests, like Rav Schechter, not like Mr. Silver. The person does have the right. It is appropriate to make significant charitable bequests. And Moshe has several arguments. One of his arguments is, a person has the right to spend money on himself. A person has the right to take vacations and to do other things and to spend his money as he sees fit. Tzedakah is a benefit for a person. A person wants to do mitzvahs. A person is, before he dies, he wants to get as many mitzvahs as he can. Giving money to tzedakah is a great source for himself. So his son can't say, leave me the money. I need the money. I need it for myself. I need to get merit. I need to have more zchus when I stand before the heavenly throne. One argument why a person should be allowed to do it. Rav Moshe then touches on another argument, which is picked up at length by Rav Asher Weiss. Yibadol ben Chaim l'Chaim. Rav Moshe argues, and a very provocative, Rav Weiss argues this at length too, a very, again, seminal, very provocative argument. They argue the Torah's concern about disinheriting the proper heirs is only when your motivation is negative. If the point of your instructions is to deprive somebody of inheritance, anger, resentment, he didn't listen to you, teach him a lesson. If you're upset at him and your goal is to take it away from him, the secondary goal is to give it to somebody else, but the primary goal is to take it away from him, that's a problem. The Torah says, don't take money, don't set out to take money away from heirs. If your primary goal is the positive, is to give the money to somebody else, whether it's tzedakah or even something else, even if you fail, one of your children is struggling, one of them has a large family, one of the children for something has special needs in his family, whatever the reason is, if you fail, one of the children just needs more money, you're not trying to take money away from anybody else. You just have a specific need for the money, even if it's not tzedakah, that's fine. The Torah doesn't care about that. The Torah only cares that you don't have a negative motivation to set out to deprive somebody of money. As long as you're doing it for some constructive purpose, that is fine. The problem is it seems to be against the long-standing tradition of the Gemara. The Gemara, even going back to the Gemara's times, one of the classic discussions about disinheriting in the Talmud is in Ksuvos, the first half of the quote from Ksuvos, number 9. The Gemara talks about dowries. I mentioned earlier that the initial discussions of giving the daughters goes back to a Talmudic discussion of dowries. The Gemara brings, the custom used to be that they used to give dowries to the daughters, which meant essentially siphoning off a portion of, you know, many sons look at their father's estate as belonging to them already in the future, and then you're taking away that money and giving it to the daughters and the son-in-laws. How can you do that? So the Gemara asks this question in Ksuvos, and the Gemara says, because there is a mitzvah, there is a halachic value, there's an imperative to help the girls get married off. Then, now, I don't know if things have gotten better or worse, but marrying people off takes money, especially marrying girls off. So that itself is a mitzvah. So you're allowed to divert money to that cause because the mitzvah of helping the daughters get married overrides the need to preserve the estate and give it to its proper heirs. Now, it's pretty clear from the Talmud, you weren't giving all the money as a dowry. You were giving a percentage, 10%. You were giving a certain amount of money for the... It wasn't all the money. Nevertheless, if not for this special mitzvah of helping the daughters, the Talmud indicates it would be usur, even though A, it's not all the money. B, it's not, that seems to indicate the stringent view, even if it's not all the money, it's still usur. And B, it was while he was alive. So it seems to indicate it's usur, even a living bequest. And C, it seems to indicate even when your motivation is not negative, even when it's a purely positive and constructive motivation, it's still usur. But nevertheless, posts can find ways to finesse that or to rule differently on all these different shilas, whether a partial donation is still a partial circumvention of Yerusha when someone's alive, for a constructive motivation. The post can have numerous reasons why they suggest it will be mutter, but nevertheless, it is a matter of great flux, very much unsettled. As I said, the practical, the generally accepted practices, we do write wills, we do give the daughters a significant portion. Some posts can say we give them, it's all right to give them as much as the sons. Some are reluctant to do that, but pretty much everyone agrees that writing a will to give the daughter something is legitimate. Some poskim say that the same way it's legitimate to give an unmarried woman a dowry to help her get married, it's similarly legitimate to give a married woman money because it's good for their shalom bayis. Even after the fact, it helps the relationship. If she's getting money from her father, it reduces tension in the marriage. Some poskim say that Rav Zalman Nechemia, I think, says that it helps her get married in the first place. Even if she doesn't have a formal dowry, if people know that she will eventually get Potiphar's father's property, it'll help her get married. So for all these reasons, poskim do generally say that giving a woman, a single woman, a single daughter, a married daughter, giving her a share of the estate, even according to many poskim, an equal share, is permitted, is a good idea. And as we started, that you always have to be concerned with avoiding jealousy, whether the jealousy should be there or shouldn't be there. Practically speaking, the jealousy will often be a real concern. And I think many poskim are sensitive to this, that we should dispose of the estate in ways that will avoid the terrible sorts of consequences that happened to the family of Yaakov and Yosef.